This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycast.
Hi there, Joysters. This is Jim, and your own is nothing sacred on Joy 94.9. And tonight is World AIDS Day Eve. And as you know, this show has had a regular discussion about HIV. And tonight we've got quite a big show to talk about a very important part of where HIV research is going. And we've got some terrific guests in the studio. So welcome, Professor Sharon Lewin.
Great to be here.
And welcome, Dr. Thomas Rasmussen.
Thank you very much.
Did I say that right or badly?
It was perfect.
Well, you never can tell with Danish. You know, you do have an Australian crown princess, so you just have to put up with it.
She speaks perfect Danish.
I know she does, but...
With an Australian accent.
I bet she does too. She is a Tasmanian after all. And I've also got in the studio my regular co-host, Steph. Hello, Steph.
Hello, Jim.
And James, who is...
Hello, Jim.
...working his usual... panel things, but without a microphone this morning today, because we've had to give his microphone across to our guests, because that's why you should be a member and you should continue to donate to Joy so that we can get enough equipment for all of us to be on air all the time. It's not hard to do. You can join tonight's discussion by SMSing us on 0427 Joy 949, and what are those numbers that Joy means, Steph?
It's 0427 569 949, or you can email onair@joy.org.au anytime in the next hour. We would love to hear your questions, feedback, comments, whatever it is, send it our way.
And as you know, Joy is the media partner for World AIDS Day this year, and tomorrow is World AIDS Day, and there's a lot of things going on at Sharon's Institute. At the Doherty Institute at Melbourne University, it starts at 9 o'clock in the morning. So we're all going to be really eyed, go out of here at 11 and take ourselves off to bed so we can get there by 9 o'clock in the morning. Now, Sharon, you are the executive director of the Doherty Institute, aren't you?
That's right.
And you were before the professor of something or other at the Burnett and the Alfred Hospital.
I was previously there. Head of Infectious Diseases at the Alfred and Monash, and head of the Centre for Biomedical Research at the Burnett.
A very accomplished woman you are too. And so you've sort of been a bit of a hero around the HIV community in Melbourne for quite some time for your research and the way in which your research has actually been explained and disseminated within the HIV community. And so we probably should start off by saying thank you. And Thomas... who I am very reliably informed is a brilliant young medical researcher from Denmark. I really was told that, you know.
It's true.
It might have been by somebody at the Doherty.
I imagine it might be.
They've got good PR over there. And you've come here to Melbourne to work with Sharon, haven't you, on a search for a cure for AIDS. And so we'll talk to you more about that in just a minute. And we've got some sort of thorny questions about that, like why do we need one?
Yeah.
So start thinking about that.
Yeah, sounds interesting.
And, well, there is a discussion about do we really need one? No, people are undetectable and uninfectious, we all think, these days. So why do we need a cure anymore? But there's something just to have in the back of your mind while we ask you some questions. Can you tell us what a search for a cure really means, Sharon?
So a cure means different things to different people. Most people, when they think of a cure, like you go to the doctor and you've got a sore throat and you get antibiotics and you're cured, is a lot tougher in HIV, meaning that you completely get rid of the virus, no longer HIV positive. I think that is going to be quite difficult to achieve. And so when we talk about cure, we really mean... HIV being in remission, meaning you no longer have to take antiviral treatment, but your virus stays at low and maybe undetectable levels, but it stays under control in the absence of treatment. I think we would love to have a true cure, meaning, oh, I had HIV, I was HIV positive, no longer have any evidence of the virus. But we've learnt that that is actually really rare, and there really is only one person truly cured of HIV, Berlin patient or Timothy Brown. But But remission seems to be...
And highly expensive, that little exercise.
Highly expensive, highly toxic. You know, clearly, for those of your listeners that don't know about Timothy Brown, he was a man that has... He is a man living in the US now, but was living in Germany at the time with HIV, had been on treatment for many years, and then had a rare form of blood cancer, which needed a bone marrow transplant. And his very clever doctor at the time thought, well, maybe if I gave Timothy a bone marrow transplant from a donor who was naturally resistant to HIV, because about 1% of Caucasians are naturally resistant to HIV.
This is the NEF gene discussion, isn't it?
This is, it's a bit, it's actually CCR5. So HIV uses a particular protein to get inside a cell.
We should stop talking in jargon, yeah. Of course.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, so this man was actually cured of HIV through his transplant. But transplants are pretty heavy duty intervention, a lot of toxicity, about 25% risk of death. But of course he had it because he had blood cancer. So he's the only man truly cured of HIV. Can't find it anywhere, and he's been off treatment now for about 7 years. But what we really want to achieve in cure research is a way for people not having to take lifelong treatment. Many could take treatment for 5 or 6 years, stop treatment, and the virus doesn't come back.
Well, I don't mind taking treatment. I mean, I was told when I was diagnosed that I had 3 years at most.
Yeah.
And that was in 1993. Now look.
Yeah, well, you raise a really good point, because treatment now is so much simpler. It's one tablet a day, not many side effects. But we live in a country which has... free treatment, easy access to medical care, pretty support. You know, there's always ways we can improve, but there's, you know, we live in an environment that we can access lifelong medical care. You know, a lot of people with HIV don't have that certainty, or even may not even have access to treatment at all. So I think the real driver for a cure, or to find a way for people not having to take lifelong treatment, is more of a global issue. Having said that, there are a lot of people, even living in Australia, who are very keen to find a way not to take therapy lifelong.
Well, if we know that a small proportion of people are resistant, has there been, I assume there has been, exploration into some kind of gene therapy where people could, we could get to a point where people could self-generate cells that would mean that they don't have, they become immune?
Yeah, yeah, no, exactly. It's exactly what's happening. So I mentioned... this molecule CCR5, so about 1% of people are CCR5 negative. So there are gene therapy studies in the US, meaning that you can chop out that gene from people's cells and put back in these cells that are resistant to HIV.
CRISPR?
Yeah, it's actually CRISPR. You know a lot of science here. I'm very impressed.
I do have a science degree.
Oh, CRISPR is like the...
She always comes in with these.
Yeah, no, we like that. Actually, this is a type of gene scissors, which CRISPR is. It's a way of chopping up genes. The one that's being used in clinical trials is a relative of CRISPR. And you basically... it's really just in a very experimental phases, but someone with HIV on treatment has a lot of their blood taken out. The gene is cut out, the CCR5 gene.
So externally, it's not somebody doesn't put micro scissors
in. No, you don't just swallow micro scissors, exactly. These are tiny little scissors.
It's not like Forbidden Body or whatever that fabulous film with Raquel Welch was, where they made them miniaturised and sent them in a spaceship into the blood vessels and they went around chopping up things in the blood.
That could work. Haven't tried that one.
Did you ever see the film? No, you should see it. You might get an idea or two.
Right. No, this is done externally, and then these modified cells are put back. And at the moment what we know is these modified cells survive. It's safe. Patients didn't get unwell with it. But once the treatment was stopped, the virus came back. And it's probably because you need a lot more of these modified cells than what was achieved in these studies. About 6% of the cells are modified. But, no, that's a great – I mean, the case of Timothy Brown spearheaded this whole movement around gene therapy.
And do they do that gene therapy by actually physically chopping up the genes, or do they do it by a sort of viral bacterial transmission?
They do it by they have to get – the gene scissors inside the cell, and sometimes you'd use viruses to get inside the cell, and sometimes you don't have to use them. In this case, they do use viruses to get the gene scissors inside the cell. It does its job, and then the cell is modified. Mm.
Thomas, can we ask you about how your research is contributing to this work?
Yeah, sure. It's a different area to what was just discussed here. The research that I've been involved with in Denmark is actually very similar to some of the stuff that's been going on here in Melbourne, and was actually sort of the whole way that my contact with Sharon got started. My boss, professor back in Denmark, has been in Melbourne before, so the two departments have sort of a long-standing relationship, and we started doing a study that was very similar to a study that's been going on in Melbourne, and Sharon was very helpful in doing some of the technical requiring analysis. So I spent 6 months here wrapping up some of the analysis and writing on that study, and that's sort of where we come into the picture. But that approach in that particular study is way different from this gene therapy. So this is about, reactivating the virus, making the virus visible inside the cells where it stays, and hoping that the immune system will then recognize infected cells and hopefully clear them off.
But is there a danger that what you'll do is wake up a nasty virulent virus that fights back fast and...
Well, not really.
It starts knocking people off because, people back in the early 90s were dying very quickly from the time of transmission or diagnosis to the time of death. It was actually a very short period of time. And so, we were all warned that, you better watch out because you might get the nasty virus, the nasty version of the virus, even though they're all HIV-1, I think, most of them in Australia. And HIV-2, which was predominantly the African virus, was considered to be much more virulent, I think, wasn't it? Is it still considered
less, less virulent?
Less virulent.
Yeah.
And so, so is there a danger that flushing them will actually make it mean and nasty and turn it into Mothra or Godzilla or something like that?
Godzilla.
Not really. So when you do this, this approach is all happening in individuals who are taking their medicine. So you're suppressing the virus and you're just trying to stimulate those rare few cells that actually contain infectious virus into producing small bits of the virus, so it's presented.
So the liberated virus will get knocked off by the various drugs
that
people are now on.
But it's still under the duress of the treatment, so even though you spark some virus to life, it's still being kept in check by the usual treatment, so no difference there really.
So I really wanted to ask you was, if you were HIV positive and you thought that you were going to participate in this trial or in this research, is there any real danger to you?
Well, I think on a general level you have to say that any research is associated with a degree of unknown. That's why you're doing the studies. So when you do a research study, you enter into new land and you can't necessarily make sure that there are no risks. It's just part of it. But what we can do is we can make sure that the risks are minimized and that they are sort of justified according to the potential benefit for either the patient or the society. So that's sort of the balance we're looking for. And that balance is also determined by the really impressive efficacy of the treatment. Patients are doing quite well on treatment, so the room for introducing very toxic research studies is not there because it's not justified.
We are going to go to a song break. If you
and
have,
then we will ask more
and
questions.
Then
about
we will
this.
Ask more. If you have any questions, you can SMS 0427 joy 949. That's 0427 569 949. You can also email onair@joy.org.au.
Hi, Jason Gibbs here, Joy 94.9 production manager. Want to learn more about radio or audio editing? We're often looking for people to join our team as program production audio producers, responsible for producing podcasts just like this one. Get involved, meet new people, and learn new skills. Join one of the biggest community radio contributors of podcasts by volunteering for Joy's program production team. All skill levels welcome, no prior knowledge of audio production is required, and best of all, training is free for all Joy members. Keep an eye on the volunteer vacancies page at joy.org.au, and if we're looking for people to join our team, it'll tell you how to get involved right there. The Joy 94.9 program production team, powering Joy podcasts. Any show, anytime, online at joy.org.au.
Hi there, Joysters. This is Jim, and you're on Is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9. It's 19 minutes past 10, and we are talking all things HIV, but particularly the search for the cure tonight, because it's World AIDS Day Eve, as you've just heard, and there's a lot of things on World AIDS for World AIDS Day on tomorrow at the Doherty Institute. And we have in the studio Professor Sharon Lewin, who's the Executive Director of the Doherty Institute, and her research colleague, Dr. Thomas Rasmussen from Denmark. When you're doing this sort of research and you want people to participate in it, how do you biopsy them to get from get reservoir samples like the gut, the brain, the liver, or wherever are the common reservoirs?
It depends on what question you're asking. So if you want to meet the whole point of why current treatment can't cure HIV is because HIV persists at very low levels, essentially hiding inside certain cells that you can find in the blood, and you can find them in tissue, like you mentioned, in the gut, in the brain, in the liver. But you can always find these cells, infected cells, in blood. So it depends what question you're asking. The studies that Thomas talked about, called shock and kill studies, trying to wake up this dormant virus, you can actually find the virus quite easily in blood. But it's over the last few years we've learned that there's a lot more virus hiding in tissue, and probably the most favourite spot of the virus is inside lymph nodes or glands of in the tissue, where you,
which are an essential part of your immune system.
Essential part of your immune system. When you're off treatment, most of the virus is replicating in those glands. In fact, when you have HIV without treatment, usually those glands become enlarged, and that often is a warning sign that something's not right. Well, even when you go on treatment and your glands go back to normal size, we find a lot more virus in those glands. We find a lot more virus in the gut tissue. Both of them are quite tricky places to find virus, but we're now learning that maybe the virus can persist there for some unique reasons. So, in fact, in more recent studies, we've been a lot more interested in finding tissue. But the initial studies of eliminating the reservoir have predominantly looked at blood. I think going forward, we will have more studies that also look at tissue, like lymph glands. Liver tissue is quite difficult to examine, though, in people that, say, also have infections with hepatitis virus, there's a better justification. There is a more of a justification for taking liver tissue. We have one study that's looking at that, at the reservoir in people that have HIV and also are infected in hepatitis B. Brain biopsy, of course, not feasible. Some studies look at the fluid that surrounds the brain and do a spinal tap and look at whether there's virus there. And you can, in some people, find virus sitting in the spinal fluid too.
Sounds all very gruesome, really, doesn't it?
Well, when we're talking about finding virus, it's really low levels. People on treatment go to their doctors, have a routine viral load test. Your doctor says you're fine, the virus is undetectable, and people do fine. We're talking about these research assays that are looking for tiny quantities of virus.
So you recently published in The Lancet, I think, about some drugs that you'd found that do flush the virus out of the reservoirs. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Sure. That was a study looking to see whether we could wake up the virus that's hiding in these dormant forms. And the reason we want to do that is if you wake up the virus, then at least the immune system can see the virus and kill the cell. These studies are commonly referred to as shock and kill, and they're always done in people that are on treatment, because when you wake up the virus, you don't want that virus to go on to infect new cells. So in this study, we had enrolled 30 individuals here in Melbourne and in San Francisco, and we gave them increasing doses of a drug called disulfiram, which is an anti-alcohol drug. It's a drug, you might know a bit about that, Jim. It's an old-fashioned drug.
It's a way to stop alcoholism, isn't
exactly.
it? It floods the receptors in the brain or something like that.
It makes you feel really sick if you drink.
Yeah.
And so it's been around since the 1950s. You take this tablet, you feel
sick. It's a good
sick.
Idea. We should put it in the water in my opinion.
So it's still used, actually, but it's used at a standard dose of 500 milligrams a day. And several years ago, another research group in the US showed that in laboratory models, this commonly used drug wakes up HIV. So we did a dose escalation study, meaning we started with a standard dose in 10 patients, in 10 individuals, then gave double the dose in 10 individuals, and then gave four times the dose.
They all feel sick. Do they get the sickness?
Well, they weren't allowed to drink when they were on the study, and our colleagues in San Francisco were convinced we would never be able to enroll anyone in Australia. But actually, we did really well. We got them just as we enrolled patients just as easily as in San Francisco, because you weren't allowed to drink for 2 weeks after you had been on the study because you'd feel sick. So that was fine. And so they only took the drug for 3 days, because the question was just, can we wake up the virus? And so we used these very sensitive ways of measuring very low levels of virus inside cells and in the blood. And we showed that at the highest dose, there was evidence that the virus woke up at a very low level. We call it more of a tickle than a shock, because it just kind of tickled and awakened the virus. The drugs were safe. People didn't get any side effects. And we think that this would be a very interesting drug to pursue, to give for longer, and perhaps in combination with something else.
It's interesting hearing you talk about the virus and, I guess, the behaviour in the body, because it sounds quite different to a lot of other viruses that people will be more familiar with, like the common cold, or like having a gastrointestinal virus where it's in one place, it makes you really sick, and then it goes away. So how does the HIV virus move around the body? Like, you're talking about cells infecting other cells. Does it sort of progress, or how does it travel around?
It travels around by infecting a cell in the blood that's able to move around the body. So all our immune fighting cells we find in blood, and they're constantly moving around. Actually, the immune system is constantly looking for foreign new viruses or infections or cancers, and it's constantly moving in and out of the blood, in and out of the tissues, moving around. So HIV infects the blood cells, and then those infected cells can move into tissue and out of tissue. The difference of the common cold is that HIV has different forms. It has a form where it actively replicates and a form where it goes silent. And actually quite a lot of viruses do that, but HIV does it in a very clever way. And when people go on anti-HIV drugs, on antiviral therapy, it wipes out that replicating form of virus. So all of that virus dividing and replicating basically gets turned off, but it's these long-lived silent forms that hang around.
So I'm really interested in translation of research into things that make a difference. And the things that make a difference are not always what clinicians think make a difference, but things like policy and practice at the bedside and so on. Are you planning, as part of these studies, to be sort of innovative and to start doing some policy type and clinical practice type workshops with people, with GPs, you know, the GPs with high caseloads and policy makers, so that they can actually learn what's happening and what they should actually support?
Yeah, I totally agree with you. You know, scientists and clinicians can't work in isolation from the community and from policymakers, but this work...
They have tried for years.
They shouldn't. I mean, it's good for everyone for us to work together, but this sort of research is still in its discovery phase. But I still think that it's meaning that we're way off changing practice and policy. We're in discovery mode, trying to discover ways that can eliminate these long-lived silent forms of virus. But these clinical trials are critical in advancing the science. And Thomas was talking about before about when you participate in a clinical trial, participants really have to understand the risks and the benefits. The benefits in these studies, not for themselves, but the benefits in science and for the broader community. And in order to really understand that well, you have to understand the science. So I still think, even though we're way off changing policy and clinical practice, we need to engage and educate and inform the community what's going on.
We need a change in culture, don't we, to get that sort of treatment as prevention thing? Because treatment as prevention was actually resisted for a long time. And yet it makes good policy sense, and it makes good economic sense. So you would think that that researchers would want to push it out into their colleagues in those areas, because they're the ones that are actually going to make it happen eventually. You just have to discover it, then they'd have to make it happen.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So when we're in this sort of discovery phase, it's really important that the community understand what we're trying to do and what the risks are and what the benefits are. We obviously have lots of other interventions that really do need to be translated into policy. So you mentioned treatment as prevention. Well, you know, knowing now that, and actually for many years we've known that if you go on treatment, your infectiousness reduces dramatically, and that can have a profound effect on new infections.
We've known that theoretically for years. That's why we have vaccinations. Not just in HIV, I mean, that's why we vaccinate in more common diseases, to reduce the community infectivity of diseases.
Yeah.
This is no different really in theory.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You reduce the overall amount of virus that's circulating in the community. Treatment does that very effectively.
Yeah.
We're going to go to a few messages, but you can participate in this conversation if you'd like. You can SMS 0427 JOY 949, that's 0427 569 949, or email onair@joy.org.au.
Dare you to.
I dare you to. Your own is nothing sacred on JOY 94.9.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, JOY 94.9.
Hello, you are on Jordan 4.9. You're listening to Is Nothing Sacred with Steph, Jim and James. And that was Connie Barnett with Depreston in honour of my brand new suburb. But good news, apparently it's written about Coburg. Sorry, Coburg. And also sorry to the listener who messaged in last time we played Courtney Barnett about 40 minutes ago and said, my ears are bleeding, I'm boycotting for 3 months. So hopefully maybe your boycott has already begun and you didn't hear that last version. But we thoroughly enjoyed it.
But that listener was boycotting her voice, not us.
Oh, we're safe.
So we're safe.
So we are in the studio talking on World AIDS Day Eve with Professor Sharon Lewin from the Doherty Institute and Dr. Thomas Rasmussen. Yes, I can say it correctly as well.
Very nice.
So Jim asked a controversial question earlier in the show, which is, why do we need a cure for HIV when people can now live a normal life with treatment and few side effects? So would you like to respond to that controversial question?
Yeah, sure. So, well, I guess there are several ways you could address that. Sharon already hinted to one of them being that really the access to treatment is not universal. So there are really large areas of the world, and probably the most heavily infected areas, that don't have access to usual HIV treatment.
But so why would that? Why would we think they were going to get access to a cure?
Well, it's just if you want to get this epidemic eventually to zero, I think you need to work on good prophylaxis, for example, a vaccine, and you need to work on a cure, because those are sort of the two long-term aspirational goals that would be instrumental in getting the epidemic down.
And they are the things, aren't they, that Bill Clinton and Bill Gates like to talk about and think that they're doing something with. And so it's actually quite sensible in one way to keep the awareness going and raise the cash.
But also I think, so even for people who are living in countries where they have free access to treatment, there are certainly many patients who are still hoping for a cure. I admit there's got to be a lot of patients who are thinking, well, I'm doing actually fine, and I can stay on this treatment for the rest of my life, no problem. So I guess just the need for a cure is not universal, but it's a driver for research and discovery, and it's an aspiration, I think, to be able to cure the disease. And for many patients, not all, but for many patients, it's a hope that they can eventually get off treatment and avoid risking transmitting disease even so.
Do you think it's likely that we will get a vaccine in the next couple of decades? Is it possible?
Within the next couple of decades, I'm not sure. I mean, I certainly believe it's possible, but I wouldn't dare put a time frame on it, neither for a cure or a vaccine.
The whole time that I've been involved in HIV community activism, which is since 1987, you know, we've talked about a vaccine's around the corner, or, you know, it'll be cured and all that sort of stuff. Mm. And a lot of us have been very sceptical about that, I have to say. And in many ways, you know, my suspicion was always that it was a bunch of researchers and doctors who just wanted to big note themselves and win the Nobel Prize. Because whoever finds a cure for HIV or for AIDS is going to win the Nobel Prize. There's no doubt about that. You know, all the precursors are there. We hope it's you, Sharon.
Well, actually,
and you too, Thomas.
The other day on with Dean, when Peter Doherty and I were in the studio, Peter having won a Nobel Prize before, Dean did ask him, "Do you think Sharon's going to win Nobel Prize?" And Peter said, "No."
How
so
dare
there
he?
There you go. Actually, it's pretty tough to win a Nobel Prize. It'll be pretty tough to find a cure too. But you know, I think one difference when we talk about a vaccine, you know, we do have lots of ways to vaccines, of course, are for people who are uninfected, and it protects them from becoming infected, just like the vaccines we have as kids. We have lots of ways to prevent HIV now. When we talked about treatment as prevention, there's PrEP, pre-exposure prophylaxis, like the pill, someone uninfected taking an anti-HIV drug each day. But all of those interventions require you to take tablets. Mm-hmm. That's quite a, you know, big commitment. They're costly, they're side effects. So a vaccine traditionally has been the only way to really, you know, prevent an infectious disease, one shot, and giving you lifelong immunity. So
I mean, I did read in the HIV media just recently about the once in every 6 months shot that somebody was talking about, and I have to say I just sort of sneered, because one, you know, if it was offered to me, I would never remember to put it in the phone to, and I'd have to rely on my GP to ring me up and go, "Get in here now." Well, I'd do it, but you know, I don't think that I could remember to do it. It's hard enough taking the tablets every day.
Yeah, these long acting antivirals. So instead of taking a tablet a day, you have an injection once every 3 or 6 months. Those of course aren't available yet. They may suit some people better than others, but you're right, for many people taking a tablet a day is easier to remember than going to your doctor every 3 or 6 months.
I guess the other thing with a vaccination compared to something like PEP or PrEP is the stigma issue, where in order to get access there has to be some acknowledgement by an individual, compared to something like a vaccine where everyone can take it as children and it's not connected to some things that might be more taboo, I suppose, especially with, I'm thinking in Africa, for example, where I know there is so much stigma and that gets in the way of a lot of treatment. And I think we kind of have to call it out, Jim, that, you know, we do have to be careful about the way we talk about this in Australia, where we have Medicare for now. And we do have a strong community. There's still a lot of stigma, but not to the same extent experienced in other parts of the world.
That is true, but we also have to think about the equity of the issue and the fact that some long-term, the history of giving long-term drugs, particularly to Indigenous women in this country, has not been a happy one in equity terms. So Depo-Provera I'm thinking of, and it was used very, very badly. And it was an effective contraception, but it was also used as a form of control. And we need to think very carefully about the policy implications about equity and so on. So I think there are lots and lots of questions that are not just about the science, but are about the way we live and the way we want to see our society develop.
It's time for our last break for the show. So this is your last chance to ask a question. No one's asked a question yet. I'm sure that you have one. 0427 joy 949. That's 0427 569 949, or email onair@joy.org.au. We found out that 600 people downloaded our podcast last month. That means people are listening. That means you're listening right now.
Well, perhaps you're not listening and you're going to listen to it later.
Damn it!
But you know, you can't participate if you do that.
Well, if you are listening, send us an email, even say hi, send in a song request and we'll play it for you next week. But for now, it's 16 minutes to 11 and you are on Is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
Anyway, Sharon, this is your first year of a World AIDS Day when you've been director of the Doherty Institute, isn't it? So what's happening there tomorrow?
So tomorrow we have a full day of great events that we're doing in partnership with Living Positive Victoria and Joy FM and the Burnett Institute.
And if we come in the morning, we'll get a cup of tea?
You'll get a cup of tea. We'll look after you. Maybe even some good coffee. Lots of good coffee places nearby. So at 9 a.m., the Minister of Health from Victoria, Jill Hennessy, will be coming and speaking to a community event largely run by Living Positive Victoria. We have a debate on PrEP. PrEP being a bit controversial. We know PrEP works, but a lot of controversy about why we don't have it, when are we going to have it, when we have it, how are we going to use it, how do you access PrEP now, who pays for it, how it works, does it raise risks of other sexually transmitted infections, all these different issues around PrEP, a community-based panel and some medical experts on PrEP. And then in the afternoon we have a fantastic seminar which has been led by young researchers that work at the Doherty and the Burnett, something called the Melbourne HIV Enterprise or MHIVE. It's a group that get together monthly and they're hosting the World AIDS Day event. We have over 130 people registered.
These are young researchers.
All young researchers just across Melbourne who are coming together for World AIDS Day. We have the keynote speaker is Jake Estes from the National Cancer Institute in the US, and he does some fantastic work on finding HIV inside tissue using these sort of fancy tools to detect HIV when it's inside tissue. We have Jenny Hoy, who's the director of the Victorian HIV Service and a very well-known HIV expert based at the Alfred, is going to talk about clinical advances in HIV management. And we have John Manwaring, man living with HIV, talking about the community experience of living with HIV.
Who gave a fantastic speech at the World AIDS Conference.
Yeah, closing ceremony, absolutely fantastic. He was brilliant. And then after that, a series of presentations by young researchers. We have over about 40 poster presentations and the best giving oral presentations and a few prizes and free afternoon tea.
More cups of tea.
Yeah. And then
tea or afternoon tea. We do both there.
And then I believe at the Positive Living Centre early in the evening, 6 o'clock or something like that. You'll have to go to our website to see this. There is a Living Positive Victoria memorial for those people that have died of AIDS, and that'll be attended by the Minister for Equality, Martin
Foley,
who's the member for Albert Park and who is the first Minister for Equality in Australia.
That's fantastic. Actually, we also have Frank McGuire, Parliamentary Secretary for Medical Research. I think the first Parliamentary Secretary for Medical Research in Victoria. He's going to open the symposium in the afternoon as well.
So it's a veritable feast tomorrow, isn't it?
It is a veritable feast of community, science and leadership.
And that's
which is
a really wonderful partnership.
About.
And that is the sort of partnership that Australia has had for 30 years in HIV and is one of the reasons why we've done as well as we've done.
Exactly.
And I think that, you know, when you go around the world to some of these other places who don't have that sort of partnership, how is it in Denmark, Thomas?
Well, I think we do quite well, actually, but you can always do better. And I'm certainly looking forward to seeing the engagement tomorrow. And Sharon been really good at sort of introducing me to the different stakeholders and people that are active in the environment. So yeah, I'm very impressed with what's going on. But I
hope you rang your mum and told her that she could listen to this on podcast.
I didn't actually, but
it's perfect. It's lunchtime in Denmark right now.
I'll podcast it for her.
I'm interested to know about attitudes towards HIV in Denmark. Is it similar to in Australia in terms of things like stigma and public understanding?
Yes, I think it's quite similar. I think. Well, not that I can say I'm an expert after spending so little time in Melbourne, but Melbourne's a bigger city than Aarhus, which is the town I live in. And I think that sort of difference in the size of the city alone makes up a difference. Otherwise, yeah, I think it's kind of similar. There's still some stigma. There's still some taboo around the disease. And I think that's also... I mean, certainly we want to get that down, but that's also driving the need for cure research because people still want to get out of it. And
what's the population of Denmark?
It's 5 million.
So it's about the same size as Victoria, really.
Yeah.
Mm. It's like being a country. It's like us being a country.
Well, it's almost the size of Melbourne, isn't it? Mm.
Yeah, Melbourne's 4 million.
Isn't it? Yeah, it's heading that way. So is Denmark the smallest of the Scandinavian countries in population size?
No, Norway is smaller.
Really?
Yeah.
Really? And Iceland is much smaller.
And Norway is much richer, though.
Yeah. Iceland technically is not Scandinavia. It's a Nordic country, so yeah.
It's over there.
It's all far away and very cold.
It's way up there in the middle of the sea.
I think the reason I mention it is because I know the population of Iceland. So I'm like, oh, somebody ask me about the population of Iceland.
What is the population of Iceland?
But that is very small.
It's just under 300,000. It's about the same size as Canberra.
And they elected a women's party government, didn't they?
They are so far ahead in so many ways compared to Australia.
Really?
Reykjavik is 100% green power, if you don't count cars, of which there are many. But the grid is a combination of hydro and wind power.
Wow.
So that's something to aspire to. And not at all related to World Waste Day.
And they have thermal as well.
Thermal.
And they have Björk.
It's time to wrap up, though. Sadly, we are running out of time. But thank you so much to our two wonderful guests for this evening. It's been really great talking to you. I feel like I've learned a lot. I was saying in the break that even though I've been talking about HIV for a year on this show, I feel like I've learned new things tonight, which has been really great. And hopefully everyone can listen in tomorrow for World AIDS Day on Joy 94.9 if you can't actually make it in person to the Doherty Institute for your new learnings and cups of tea.
And sorry that we kept you up so late, you two, coming all this way in. And we'll have to all rush home to bed now so that we can get up and be in there in the morning. And thank you, James, for the panelling. Thank you, Steph.
Thank you, Jim.
And we'll see you all next week.
Good night.
Good night, everyone.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.